Hello and welcome to the third season of Somerset Stories, the podcast which explores the lives of the people who live, work and create in Somerset. My name is Lewis Webb and each week I get to share the stories of some of the inspiring, creative and successful individuals and families that make this beautiful county their home. This season we'll also be showcasing some of the area's musical talent, with tracks from local artists being played in each podcast. This week we've got a great tune from Bristol-based folk singer-songwriter Jake Morgan. As ever, your comments, reviews and feedback are always appreciated. And if you'd like to send us a message, you can email hello@somersetstories.com. My guest this week is artist, block printer and microfarmer Jay Bess. Growing up in the county, Jay has always had strong values around how we can be better stewards of the land that surrounds us and wants to create a movement which gives better access to communities looking to produce their own foods in a sustainable way. To communicate this, she creates signature prints which celebrate the freedom that food production and foraging gives us. Most recently, her family has embarked on a micro-farming project with the aim of bringing the food that we eat a lot closer to home. Jay, welcome to Somerset Stories.
Hi, it's nice to be here.
We're recording just after Easter, but this is going to go live on the 1st of May. And Somerset is quite full of May Day traditions. Are there any that you consider a favourite?
I don't know about a favourite. Growing up, we had to do an awful lot of dancing around the maypole, and I'm not the most coordinated of people. So it was always a faintly traumatic affair. I do think we went once to a maypole competition, but I don't think our school was actually allowed to take part. But I went to a tiny school and there was only seven in my year group, so we probably weren't worth much of a watch. But we do the chasing. We have gone to the chasing the Beltane dragon in Glastonbury just the once.
Right.
So lots of waving pots and pans and shouting at it, but we didn't follow it all the way up the tour. Not quite that ambitious.
I don't know how they're going to do it this year. I suppose we will find out. Maybe small groups.
Small groups chasing the dragon.
Small groups of six chasing dragons up the tour. Just like constantly all day.
Yeah, on a relay. I like it.
You're in West Pennard.
I am.
And we've recently had on Venetia Dearden, who is a photographer from East Pennard.
Mm.
Is there some unspoken rivalry between Pennards that I don't know about? Or do you get along okay?
It took us about a year to work out where East Pennard is, so I don't think we're quite connected enough for a rivalry. Sadly not. I'm going to disappoint.
It's not quite as big, is it?
No, I'm afraid I've got no drama to share on East Pennard.
Okay, fine. No beef.
Sorry.
I wanted to properly thank you for coming on the podcast because way back in July of last year, I discovered your creations on Instagram and invited you to come on, and a lot's happened since then, but we've finally managed to find a time to have a chat.
We have. It's nice after all this time.
Your story begins not too far from where you are now.
No. So I was born in Cranmore, and there was just a couple houses there, and it backed onto Cranmore Woods. It was a really idyllic place to live. The front view was all the fields and the back was the woods, apart from the odd cow that would break in. It was a really beautiful place to grow up.
Break into the garden or break into the
house? We had a hedgerow. So there was one field at the back before the woodland. And there would always be at least one nosy cow poking its head through. Probably only happened once, but it traumatized us so massively that it's the big deal of our childhood.
And when you're a kid, a cow is
a super big
animal.
The garden. Absolutely.
Had your family always been based in the area?
No, my mum was born in Kent and my dad was from somewhere up north. And I think they'd planned to live in Dorset, but ended up stumbling into Somerset. I was born at home in Cranmore, so I count myself as Somerset born and bred, even though I think actually you probably have to be at least three generations Somerset to be able to claim that.
What did your parents do? What brought them here?
They were both nurses. But my understanding is that they both actually met because they shared a love of motorbikes. And my dad ended up, I think he was managing. So my dad killed himself when I was four. So I'm not, and I actually have quite a lot of odd memories of my dad. So he took me to a nursing home, the nursing home where he worked. I can't think where it was now. I think it was actually just outside of Somerset. But, you know, when you're four, you remember things like the old people who give you the PG tip. No, it wasn't PG tip monkey. There was a dog, a PG tip's dog. And I remember the fact that he used to make me the jam sandwiches with white bread. So actually, my memories of him in the area are nothing other than, you know, what a four-year-old appreciates, which is white bread jam sandwiches. But my mum worked as a nurse, and I don't think that could have been easy being a single parent working as a nurse with two small children. But that makes it sound like it was really doom and gloom. It was actually a really charmed time. It was a beautiful house in a beautiful area, and it was me, my mum, and my brother all the time. It was a really special place.
Did it take a little bit of time for you to kind of grow up and actually understand death in the family as well?
I think when you're a child, you don't understand it in the way you do as an adult. I think you grieve in a really different way because you don't understand your parents as individuals. When you're a child, you kind of, you grieve a role, don't you? I read once that if you lose a parent as a child, you spend your life grieving, which sounds really dramatic. But I think because you don't process it in the same way, you lack, you know, you lack the parental role rather than the individual that they were. So I think you understand it differently as you grow.
Is your brother older or younger?
I have a little brother. He's a couple years younger, so he was only 18 months.
So yeah. It wasn't as if he was, be the man of the house.
No, not at all. My brother's always been the funny little brother. My mum did nursing and was a potter. So she had a studio at the end of the garden and made ceramics for years. And that was wonderful when we were kids because we got to go. It wasn't for her. I'm sure it was absolute hellish. And I know she worked before we woke. She worked after we'd gone to bed. She worked every hour of the day. But as kids, you don't see that. You see messy pottery. And going to craft fairs. And I mean, I'm pretty sure we annoyed every single other market holder there. But I do remember a day where I got to hold someone's boa constrictor to get attention to his reptile stand. I annoyed the lady that had, what's it called, FEMO, like modelling clay, until she gave me a free packet. We were deeply irritating children, but it was such a great place to have a childhood going to craft fairs. It really, especially when you think all the big ones in London in the run-up to Christmas. It was very festive.
Was that love for art something that carried through to school as well?
Yeah, as a kid, if you'd asked me, I'd have told you I was going to be an artist, an author, and a vet. And I was very set on those things. What I probably took from that was my mum being a potter. And her mum was, my mum was a ceramicist. Her mother was a potter. But I think probably what I took from that was the amount of work that she put into it. There wasn't ever kind of swanning around and fiddling with things. My mum grafted to do her work. And I think that's probably what I took forward was how hard you work. And I did take it to school, but coming from a single parent family, which it was absolutely charmed and wonderful, but financially not an easy thing. I don't think I saw art as an option for a really long time because you have to be able to provide for yourself. And actually, I went to school and was quite academic and funneled myself in and ended up studying medicine for 2 years, which I failed catastrophically and I'm deeply proud of. It's the best thing that's ever happened in my life is not becoming a doctor. But I ricocheted into a different degree as an answer to failure and did speech therapy, which I also didn't love. And so I've gone full circle. It's taken a long time, but now I'm back doing this.
Interesting again that's the two elements of your parents being nurses and then also the creative outlet of pottery. You've tried your hand at both of them.
Somewhere between healthcare and art. And my partner is still a doctor. Healthcare is very much still. And my mum, until my nonna came to live with my mum in the village last August, my mum was still working as a nurse. So it's very much a healthcare family.
For some people, growing up in a rural community and the kind of idyllic, natural, outdoorsy sort of childhood that you described, there's often a pull when you get a bit older to move to a city and to be somewhere that's, you know, there's more going on. Was that ever on the cards for you?
I don't think I ever thought about it as a pull. I was excited to go to university. I was excited for the independence. But actually, I found the process of moving to a city really overwhelming. I mean, we hadn't lived in the countryside for all of it. We'd moved to Shepton Mallet beforehand. It's quite a small town. It's not very metropolitan.
The bright lights of Shepton.
The bright lights, yes. But I found it really overwhelming getting used to that, actually. I think that moving to a house, after Halls, moving to a house that had streetlights outside of it all the time and the kind of constant noise and... Yeah, it was a really different experience. I'm glad I lived there for the time I did, but I wasn't sorry when. So after we lived in Cardiff, me and my partner moved and had my son in Brissington in Bristol, and it was wonderful. But a little terrace garden overlooked on all sides, doesn't have any of the same charm. And we had absolutely wonderful neighbors. I mean, you get a lot of community, but at a high cost of privacy. And actually, having moved to West Pennard, we still have our street is wonderful. There is a high degree of community, but the sense of space, I think I feel very lucky to have got back, massively privileged. But we still have friends in the city, and you know, they talk about the great places they've gone for dinner and all the great cultural things they can access. And I'll convince myself, but after two nights being there, I'm very happy to come back home.
Yeah, I was reading, I think on one of your blogs, that, you know, during your time in the outskirts of Bristol, you essentially were turning that house and the garden into a little slice of the countryside by growing vegetables, keeping animals, that kind of thing.
When we first bought, we bought a little ex-council house in Keynsham. And it was, I think my stepdad Steve described it as like the last of the good council houses, you know, and they still had decent insulation and a good sized garden. And Keynsham's lovely, but it was there was quite a lot of, I think, what a diplomatic way of putting it, we had a lot of stuff stolen from our garden. So it wasn't the easiest area to live in. A lot of people came into our garden and took vegetables and things, and it didn't always feel very comfortable. But there was something really lovely about a place that I guess outwardly didn't look very romantic, and being able to create this wonderful garden space in a front garden that had just been a drive it's just a magic, isn't it? Being able to put plants in and it feels completely different. It was such an overgrown jungle. And I think that was when we overcrowded everything. It was a dreadful garden productively. But the amount you could squeeze into a small and grotty space is wonderful. It felt very homey.
There are two things I want to explore in a bit of depth with you. Your block printing work and the micro farm that you have. And through embracing the sort of responsible stewardship of that land, the way in which you are, for lack of a better word, rebelling against what's happening in farming today, the fact is that those two outlets are inherently combined, because what you create in art is a reflection, maybe, on what you're doing on the land itself. So I'm going to start by asking a fairly broad question, which is, what is wrong with how land is currently being used in this country?
That's a broad question. I think it's a really hard thing that you have to have such a degree of privilege to be able to grow your own food, that to even have a garden space isn't something everyone, I mean, maybe not everyone wants it, but it's certainly not something you can expect to have. In order for us to be able to access the land that we are growing on, which is 2.3 acres, we've come at it as a whole family. And even then, there are people in this area who buy up any available land at prices that are obscene. You know, the first field we looked at, I think, went for over 70,000, which for a field is that's beyond what most people could ever fantasize about accessing. And food production should not be a privilege. It should be a fundamental human right to be able to access to, or the ability to grow your own kind of good, nourishing, culturally appropriate food. We've already had comments. So very early on, someone went past field. And to be honest, most people who stop at the gate have been unbelievably kind and interested and friendly. But we had someone very loudly making a comment for us to hear about, well, you know, they get 4 sheep and they call themselves farmers. Just to be clear, at that point, we were just people that owned 4 sheep and were a bit worried about what to do next. But I think there is this sense that farming is done in a particular way. And when you consider the damage that intensive agriculture has done to the landscape, it seems quite odd. It can feel quite challenging to have people defending that. And I don't think it is the fault of the individual farmers. It's a system that has created one accessible way of farming. If prices are driven down, people are forced to do it, and more, they're forced to change how they do it to make it more and more economical. If you have access to a large patch of land, to manage that land, you have to buy, you're forced to buy bigger machinery. In order to justify the cost of the bigger machinery, you're going to have to plant monocultures, that the prices are driven in a way that you need to grow more and more of the same crop. And it's driving it to a place of, it is an unsustainable way to continue to manage the land. So the fact that the whole food system is shrouded in secrecy, and that we are unable to see and understand how our food is being produced. For example, I know you and I at the start were talking about tomatoes and how good tomatoes in season cost. And yet we can buy in the supermarket tomatoes that will say grown in the UK. And you think, well, great, it's grown in the UK. But at no point is anyone explaining to us the processes that grow to the energy required to grow tomatoes out of season in this country, the energy that goes into. And I think with that amount of greenwashing, even when you are trying to make the right choices, it's impossible to know, to understand where your food has come from.
I guess, broadly speaking, some of the effects of that would be a homogenization of what we consume as a as a culture, and also, you know, a lack of specialization in certain foods. And also the point you made around the access to land being something that, you know, requires huge, huge financial outlay. One of the other effects of that is, yeah, it's going to be sort of more and more people being priced out of, as you say, just the ability to have a small area where, you know, even if they're not looking to live the good life and become completely self-sustaining, to grow at least part of their own food, that's becoming less and less of an option as well, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I love the idea of self-sufficiency. I don't think it's enough. I love the idea of community sufficiency, that if more people had this access, if more people are able to choose bits of what they want to do, that we would be able to act as a community to support food within our area. And as you say, you know, with homogenization, the homogenization of what we eat, I mean, that isn't just of what we eat, it's of what's available for us to eat. It's based on what can be freighted, what can be transported, what grows reliably. It's got absolutely nothing to do with the quality of the food we want to eat. And yet, I know Glastonbury, I haven't been there yet because, you know, COVID, but they have seed swap days, and there are communities of people who want to do it differently. But it's so hard if it requires such a level of privilege to be able to access that in a more meaningful way.
And I don't think it's very, very niche seeds and plants that we're talking about here. I remember distinctly as a child, gooseberry season. And I know that's something which is maybe a little bit more prevalent now, but it's just not as common as it used to be, because they're not as popular, they're harder to grow than other crops.
Absolutely. I know that there is, but there's companies like Heirloom Seeds where in order to be able to access their seeds, you have to become a member. And I think the same for the Real Seed Company. So you pay a pence on top of your order to become a member, and then they're allowed to give you these seeds as a member, because the sale of seeds is so heavily controlled that there are set seeds that are allowed to be sold within it, like the idea of what wheat you are and aren't allowed to buy. My son decided he wanted to make pizzas from scratch, and we briefly looked at how it is to grow wheat, and it's the list every year is diminished of what wheats are allowed to be sold. So the older wheats, the more traditional ones, are just being bumped off that list because people aren't growing them. But now it's no longer legal to sell those seeds. You can only do them through seed swaps and seed collectives. It seems so bizarre to control what food people are allowed to grow.
And the knock-on effect to the surrounding nature as well, you know, that food is not just for us. It's the natural ecosystem that feed on those seeds, those berries and various other things as well.
And if you're planting things in that way, in monocultures, you're reducing biodiversity significantly. So we've been planting up silver pasture over the last couple months. And so it's a kind of form of alley cropping, which is mixing agricultural enterprises with woodland, essentially. So for us, we're planting rows of trees and shrubs and having gaps in between where our sheep will forage. And it creates these systems where, so the trees will provide shade and shelter for the sheep. The sheep will, in the first, keep the grass down to help everything else establish, but they'll also fertilize the ground. And then the trees are working on the carbon sequestration. And the you know, that later it will provide browsing for the sheep, and the trees then are also then providing habitat for the biodiversity for like beneficial insects. And then you've got the beneficial insects right there on the land that will then predate, you know, you've got your ladybirds for your aphids. It's all together, but you can't do that on a monoculture. Well, actually, that's a lie. You can do. There are people doing great schemes where they're selling strips of land down the middle, strips down the middle of fields for people to plant trees in to create this. But it's unusual. It's not the mainstay yet. Mm.
You mentioned sort of the major landowners and that being something where the acquisition of more land is a problem. But you touched on that whole idea of it being the monoculture that's the bigger issue here, because the fact is that major landowners as a concept is not new. We had the feudal system 1,000 years ago, but the management of the land was done very differently.
I suppose it's the start of the progression towards what we recognize as, you know, the industrial agriculture that we face now. You know, the machinery's got bigger and it's become more intensive, but it's part of that process.
So with all of that kind of knowledge and philosophy, I suppose, you went into the project of your micro farm with your eyes, while not kind of fully open and fully aware of everything that you might face, at least partially open to the challenge ahead. Is that a fair assumption?
I think that we went at it with a huge amount of enthusiasm. So we got the field, I think probably about 2 months after lockdown. No, about a month after lockdown began. And I don't know if you remember, but do you remember when the news was filled with all the eggs that were being wasted because of cafes and bakeries unable to sell it? And there were just thousands of eggs going to landfill. They could not be sold because we didn't have the infrastructure to sell those eggs to the people who could not get eggs in the supermarkets when the supermarkets were running out. And at that moment of realizing how little this system serves anyone other than the supermarkets, the businesses involved, I think we had a huge amount of motivation to try and improve our resilience as a family, but also whilst we're still working out what this will look like as part of the community, it very much is with the hopes that it will provide community resilience, you know, more food growers within our location.
Bristol-based Jake Morgan is a singer-songwriter whose husky voice and vintage writing style are evocative of a bygone musical time, weaving together threads of folk, country, bluegrass, jazz and blues with emotionally driven and relatable songs that draw influence from his life and travels. This is his 2020 single, Every Dog Has Its Day.
Limit and you're just about ready to crack. Keep on walking, don't look back. Ain't no game without pain. And every dog has its day. In the palace of angels and dreams, you see no sun. Are you fighting the battle that could never be won? Nothing ventured, nothing came. Every dog has its day. Every cat has my lies. Everybody got a story to tell. Every action has a reaction. We and God raise the sea. All and you nearly got nothing left. Most people give up when they're on the edge of success. And the Lord works in mysterious ways. Every dog has its day. as my legs. Everybody got a story to tell. Every action has a reaction. We anchor, raise the sail. Maybe tomorrow could be a matter of years. Nothing gonna stop at the time, do not fear. Fortune favors the brave. And every dog has its day.
So where did you start? Did you kind of go in with a vision of like, okay, well, this is the type of thing that we want to produce and grow? Was it kind of, let's take a husbandry approach? What was sort of the plan once you acquired the land itself?
I think because there's quite a lot of us involved, so it's my mum and Steve, and obviously me and my partner, James, and then we've got my stepsister who's involved and my brother who comes down to help occasionally. I would say that my parents are the ones who have the big vision. You know, they've got the market garden, they knew where the pond was going to go, they had land levels sorted. But we've kind of been chipping in the bits that excite us as we go along. You know, we're all demanding which vegetable gets added where, and we've spent the weekend digging in the beds where. So eventually we're hoping flowers will be kind of part of so we're planting it up into gardens, and each garden is of 750-foot beds, and we're hoping flowers will be part of it to encourage insects into it. But for the moment they're in one place, because everything has to be manageable whilst we learn how to plant and harvest and just get these rows in. Going from planting a garden to a 50-foot row is a completely different concept of how many seeds you're sowing. And the sheep were mine. I'd spent the year before trying to find anyone who would lend me field space to keep sheep in, so sheep were mine. But we're all kind of figuring out the bits that excite us and the bits that we want to do and contribute. It is a family effort.
And you're also raising a family on the land as well. How much do they get involved, and how much do you think they take in?
I think they take in so much. My son is 7. I have to confess, he's not the most enthusiastic farmer. He mostly sits in the trailer reading his Tintin comics. But then, you know, he asked to make pizza from scratch because he had the revelation that we'd never really make pizza from scratch because we hadn't grown the wheat. So he's clearly absorbing it in the way that it interests him. And we're working hard not to push it, as much as you cannot push it on a child who is forced to sit at a field for about 7 hours a day at the weekend. My daughter loves it all. She's 4, is a deeply enthusiastic sower of seeds in inappropriate places, and rough hands pricking out various small seedlings. But she already remembers names of lots of the weeds, and they all help plant trees. I hope that they see the work that we're doing and that we view food as worth that work. I think that we live in a culture that massively denigrates food production. You know, everything I've said about intensive agriculture, that's not the farmer's fault. They've been forced into this space. When you think of how little the crop pickers are paid, and how we don't know who is making our food, and actually eating with people is a deeply intimate thing. It's so important to know what you're growing and where it nourishes you. And I hope our children take on board the fact that that's important, even if they don't particularly want to do the same work as they grow. We recently bought some rabbits with the hope of breeding rabbits for meat. And it's funny, that seems to be the tipping point for a lot of people, the idea of cute rabbits. But we've been vegetarian for years. And I think I feel quite excited that the kids are involved in this process of understanding that even meat is connected to animals that they see, that every step of the way they will understand the connection, even if they don't want to. My son is, you know, hardcore vegetarian, has no plans to change it, but he is comfortable with the fact that we're doing this process around him.
You mentioned earlier your approach to food production is based on community as well. How hard has it been to work on this project without that ability to connect with people in close proximity?
It's been really hard. It's been hard for us setting this up because the field came into our lives during the pandemic, and we've had to do everything, you know, careful social distancing. And that's really hard for little kids to spend whole days at the field with their grandparents and not be allowed that interaction. recently there are some lovely people in the village who've come and helped. We've been assembling a polytunnel, and we've started to have community support and people coming up, but again, it's not the way we would have liked it to have been. The year before, we helped plant trees at Plotgate, who are in Butley, and that was wonderful. So many people came together to plant these trees, and I think we'd hoped that maybe by this year, when we had to plant the same number of trees, we'd be able to ask people to come and help us with that. And as it was just us as a family, social distancing, planting, you know, 70 trees over 2 days, and having a community does improve things somewhat.
When did you first start block printing?
I booked to go on a course in Cardiff and it got cancelled. So my partner bought me one of those little beginner kits, and I spent a good couple hours sat on my bed in my room carving out a scene, and I tried to make some adorable map scene. It had some mountains, had some words, and I had completely missed the fact that you reverse the print. So everything was mirror image when I printed it out after all those hours. So it wasn't an auspicious start, but it improved after that.
So talk me through the process then, from coming up with the idea or being inspired to make something to actually seeing it in print. How does it actually work?
So I draw an awful lot, and my sketchbooks are mostly filled with utter rubbish. But once I have the idea there, I will try and sketch it out. I know lots of people can draw straight onto lino, but I think because I include lots of things like text and stuff, I find spacing, I can never get it right if I'm very free. So I draw it into a sketchbook, and then I trace it onto tracing paper, which I then flip, now knowing about reversing things, onto the block and burnish it onto it with the back of a spook crayon, and go from there. So you carve out your block, which can either be lino, or I'm using more wood blocks now, but most things that I've had previously on my Instagram are lino, but wood is so much nicer to carve. So I carve fastidiously for days, absolutely enraged at every mistake because you can't glue them back. And then you proof it. So the whole thing gets inked up. You kind of keep your fingers crossed. And I've just bought myself a print press, which is very exciting. But until last week, I have done the whole thing with the back of a wooden spoon onto a piece of paper. And it's like a rubber stamp. So as you peel it off, the print is on the paper, and you see what you've made. And I don't think I've ever made a print. I've never carved a print and it turned out on paper how I was expecting it to, not once. And mostly I would say that's for the better. There's a lot more, there's noise and mistakes that make it unique. There have been a few disappointments recently.
So how has your work evolved over time then, as you do more of it?
I think, so when I started, my work resembled other people's that I like. I spent a lot of time making work that looked too much like other people's. And we painted a mural at our house in Keynsham. So our house backed onto the garages of some flats, and the garages wall made up a big part of our garden. And it was an awful grotty red brick thing. So we painted it up white, and I'd never painted something big before. I was really excited to just have a go. And I painted a piece. Do you remember the war propaganda, like dig for victory? And I tried to paint something like that on the wall. It definitely stood out like a sore thumb in the estate, but I loved it so much that when we left, I knew the next step people were going to paint over it. So I turned it into a lino print, and changing that into a block resonated in a way with me, but also it was the first time that I had sold prints in a really meaningful way, and it kind of progressed from there. The realization that my prints didn't just have to be, I couldn't quite work out what it was I wanted to put down, and none of the pictures, they just seemed bitty, and there'd be a fish, a plant, and it was a realization that actually the propaganda, the things I believe in could also be put onto paper. That was a really exciting revelation. It changed massively how I worked and what the purpose of my work was. It felt, I found a meaning in what I was making.
You wrote on your blog that the land around us resembles that kind of rural England of storybooks. And it's only, as we were talking about, when you look closer that you notice that things aren't necessarily as perfect as they might seem. So is that part of the reason, again, as you say, behind that sort of propaganda approach? Is it to help raise awareness of things that aren't the obvious problems?
I definitely would agree with that. It is in part that. But I think it's also, I want the work that I make and I guess the life I lead and the food we grow to all feel hopeful. I think this is a really bleak and hard time. And I know that every conversation we've had with our friends on Zoom has got progressively more depressing as the years gone on. And actually, I think it's more important than ever to be hopeful and to not doom scroll and consume media that leaves you feeling like there is no purpose and there is no hope, because it just stifles your ability to continue to act. You have to act like there is hope and that the things you do, however small, will make a difference. So yes, it is a protest against those things, but it's more that I want there to be a radical joy in the small stuff, the important bits.
And I suppose being a mother, you have to have that balance as well between, as you say, trying to instill a view of the world that is beneficial for your children growing up, but also being hopeful and giving them hope for the future.
I think it's a lot of hope in being resilient, isn't there? The idea you can offer your children a way to continue to exist and enjoy their lives, however, whatever that's going to look like in the future landscape.
I would say that your most recognisable prints are those which could be considered those sort of statement pieces that have, for lack of a better word, the slogans on them. You mentioned the sort of the Dig for Victory as that being kind of the slogan that started it off. Where did the inspiration for things like Resistance is Fertile come up from?
I don't remember where that one came from. Probably my mum. She's great at things like this. My mum's a brilliant person to run things by. My mum is a very hopeful person, and she's deeply supportive and very good at criticising what I do. But I think through the criticisms, all of them are better. So that was probably my mum. But the other ones, I think the Foraging is Freedom was, I think it came with a revelation that a lot of the things we do, and it's wonderful how, you know, lots of these things, like everyone's picking wild garlic in on social media. But how exciting is that? That all of the things that have become trendy are things that are so much more connected to the seasons and connected to the food we eat. You know, the thing about that scaling back and everyone still being enthusiastic is fairly wonderful, isn't it?
It's funny you mentioned that, because I think, you know, looking at social media, one of the things that there's a real market for in that kind of lifestyle space is what some people would call cottagecore, which is that sort of very quintessential chintzy countryside, but in quite a styled out way. And I think the foraging element is, it's a little bit more kind of getting your hands dirty than, you know, having a really nice table set which is full of wildflowers, right? There's a bit more of an edge to it.
Yes, I wouldn't ever want to denigrate things that make people feel hopeful and connected and things that are simpler, for sure. But I would say that we're not very good at the cottage core existence. Our cottage averaged like 9 or 10, it's a log. Our cottage is only heated by wood burners and we averaged about 10 degrees all winter. It is, it's lacking that romance. Yeah, I would say that our version of that is far more hands-on and much less pretty. But, you know, we'll work on the pretty, we'll get there.
And what's the reaction been to your print work? I know you've gathered a really sort of sizable following on Instagram of people who are appreciating your work. What are the type of comments that people make?
I think for Instagram, for me, it's been a really supportive place. People are wonderful. They're really are really helpful. I think more than the reaction to my work has been the joy of being able to ask questions about, you know, weed identification or particular feathers or planting support, and the ability to make friends around the world through it. That I have a friend that I write to regularly now through who lives in France, and I have regular phone chats with a friend who lives outside London. And these are all people who are growing their own food, who are sharing their own lives. It's been a real source of connection, I would say.
With your printing, as with your land, there's an emphasis on much smaller levels of production. It's not a mass producing of, you know, thousands of cards and prints. It's very much you at your kitchen table, knocking out one at a time. Is that important to you, that this is something that, you know, no matter how popular your art gets, it's never going to be mass produced?
I mean, I will claim that this is all deliberate and not because I'm poorly organized. I do love the ability to mass produce, but to produce multiples from lino cut. That's part of why I find it really exciting, is that it makes unique bits of artwork accessible and affordable for, I mean, not everyone, but many more people than, you know, an original oil painting would be. I love the accessibility of it. But yeah, I do like the small batches. I feel that I am able to keep it a sustainable part of my life alongside other things. I love making prints, but I also love growing food, and I love being a parent, and all these things have to exist in a balance if I'm going to continue to love all of these things. I would continue to love my children, to be fair. We've done a year of lockdown and I'm still quite fond of them. But yeah, I think it is important to me because it's part of the balance of it all working together.
So we are at the beginning of May. That is quite a hopeful time, I suppose, in the world of growing things and producing foods. What are you most excited about in the next few months?
Obviously, everything I'm going to say is about family. I'm very excited to be able to have time working with my family without distancing. That will be a game changer. But I think every season I get into, I think, is the best one. The daffodils come out. Spring is absolutely my favourite. How could it not be my favourite? And we go through them all. But I think harvest time, once we get to the summer, when everything is just throwing off plants and you're kind of, you know, catching courgettes out of the air, is the bit that I can't wait for that. I think we spent a lot of time doing the work of digging beds, of planting trees, of, you know, we're getting through the muddy patch and the sheer amount of standing water and chasing sheep in winter, and the prospect of reaping some of the bounty of that work is really an exciting thought.
Jay, before we go, where can people find out more about you, the work you're doing, your art, anything that they might want to know more about?
So I'm on Instagram as JBess, so it's J-A-I Bess. I have a website that's the same name, but .co.uk. But for the field, we're actually called Useful Beyond Buildings, which is the What Three Words address for the place, which seemed very serendipitous. And as yet, there isn't a lot to, I mean, if anyone's cycling by and wants to say hello over the gate, that's wonderful. But we're really hoping later in the summer that we'll have a stand up to be able to sell some of the produce. And it's always exciting to meet people. But we do have an Instagram, which is Useful Beyond Buildings.
Jay, thank you so much for your time. It's been wonderful talking to you and getting to know more about what you're up to.
Thank you. It's been really lovely. It's been a lovely chat. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Somerset Stories. If you liked it, you can subscribe on Apple, Spotify, Google, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to get in touch, you can find us on social media at Somerset Stories or email hello@somersetstories.com. Music on all Somerset Stories productions is created by Jazar. You can be found at betterwithmusic.com. See you next time.